Hello, hello, hello. Welcome to another episode of MotoGPOD, a podcast about motorcycle road racing. I'm your host, Bob Hayes, and today is Friday, September 23rd, 2005. This is the 20th episode of MotoGPOD. That's kind of cool, sort of a milestone. When I started this last June, I wasn't sure how far I was going to go, to be honest with you. The first few shows are pretty painful for me to go back and listen to, but I think I've improved, and hopefully it'll keep getting better. It's 20 episodes. Wow. Maybe for the 25th episode, I'll have to think of something fun to do for the MotoGPOD Silver Anniversary. Actually, thinking about it, aren't people supposed to do something special for me on the Silver Anniversary? So, we'll have to see. All right, I've got some good stuff today, got a really big show. We've got some news items and some other great stuff for today's show. First off, there's another Vincent Haskovic benefit. Then we're going to have some more thoughts on why Motegi is so challenging for so many riders, as evidenced by last weekend's 50% attrition rate in the MotoGP race. I've got some interesting articles that showed up in the Italian press from Francesco Ardia, MotoGPOD listener, and he kindly translated those for me, which is just well, because I don't speak Italian. And we have a great eyewitness race report from Motegi from Yoshi Uchiyama in Japan that I'm going to read. And then I'll finish all up with a combined look at the combined standings and a preview for the Marlboro Malaysian Motorcycle Grand Prix at Sabang this weekend. And I was going to do a segment about the Yamaha technical presentation at Motegi, where Yamaha gives some details about the future of the YZR M1 motorcycle and their Hue machine technology and all that business. But as it is, this is going to be a long episode with a lot of good stuff, so I'm going to save that one for another show. But if you can't wait, RideOn2.com staffer Heidi Kender actually went to that press conference. He had the full meal deal press card and everything. I mean, how cool is that? So you can check out his report at RideOn2.com. That's two spelled out T-W-O. And as usual, I'll put a link on the show notes and up on the website and everything pointing to that. It's pretty neat stuff. And Heidi did a great job of writing it all up, at least for the first part. But we're still waiting on the second segment to go up. So what's going on there, Heidi? Where is it? Laguna Seca issued a press release on September 15th, just a little while ago, about an auction to benefit injured AMA racer Vincent Haskovic. If you remember, 31-year-old Haskovic suffered paralyzing injuries in a crash while racing in the AMA Formula Extreme race last May at Infineon in California, which Infineon is the track that's really known as Sears Point, by the way. The press release had this to say: "Don't miss a chance to own a piece of history while helping Vincent Haskovic. Mazda Raceway Laguna Seca is offering motorcycle fans an opportunity to own a unique piece of history while at the same time donating to a great cause. 10 3-foot by 8-foot banners that lined the city of Monterey's Fremont Street during the Red Bull U.S. Grand Prix will be available for bid in a blind auction." By the way, that's about 91.5 centimeters by 243.8 centimeters for those of you that think in metric. So it's a pretty good-sized banner that would look great hanging anywhere. Each of the banners has been personally autographed by race winner Nicky Hayden of Owensboro, Kentucky. The proceeds from the auction will be donated to the Wegman Benefit Fund to assist with Vincent's medical costs. Vincent's medical insurance is only paying 70% of his bills, and the total for that stuff is well over $500,000 at this point. His team, M4 Emgo Suzuki, it's continuing to pay his salary right now, but they can't do that forever. And in any event, AMA privateers don't make a huge amount of money anyway. So these costs are just adding insult to injury for old Vincent. The press release continues. Bids will be taken exclusively at the Laguna Seca website at laguna-seca.com. And I'll put these links in the web show notes and on the MotoGPOD homepage. The minimum bid is $750, and the 10 highest bids will each win one of the banners. In a blind auction, bidders are unable to see other participants' bids. The auction will run from Wednesday, September 21st through Wednesday, September 28th, 2005. So you guys have till next Wednesday if you want to make a bid on these. I know $750 is a fair amount of money, but it's a really good cause, and I'm sure that some of my listeners out there would like to have a chance on bid on something like this. So if you don't get a chance to bid in this auction for whatever reason, but you do still want to help Vincent out, there's some links on the Team M4 MGO site that for the Wegman Benefit Fund and the Road Racing Action World Road Racing World Action Fund, that kind of thing. So check it out. Like I said, the links are all on the MotoGPOD.com site. All right, last show, you might remember that I had a listener question from Jennifer Haynes where she asked what I thought about why do so many riders have a problem with Motegi? And I basically gave a couple of theories that either riders are underestimating the track because of its reputation as sort of non-challenging or not overly technical, or possibly that because it's a fairly difficult track for passing, with not offering a lot of passing opportunities, so that when they do try to make a pass, they tend to be on that very ragged edge. Well, I got a few more comments from other listeners that I thought were worth passing on. Greg Fredrickson from Australia writes, I'd agree with part of your answer for the listener's email. Motegi, from a rider's point of view, and my point of view in Gran Turismo 4, is a rather boring track when compared with others from the season. The commentators here described it as a stop-go track, where every time there's a straight, there's either a 90-degree corner at the end of it or a hairpin. However, from a TV viewer's point of view, the track as a crash fest can be entertaining, because everyone loves a bit of good old-fashioned destruction. But when half the field is crashing out on this one track, something needs to be done to keep the rider's concentration up. And so that's one vote for one of my answers, kind of. Notice I actually did two answers in that last podcast to kind of cover my bases and double my chances of coming up with something good. But then I got another email from Tom Crisman, also known as Swamp, and he wrote a little bit more detailed story that takes a different view of things. Tom had this to say. He says, first of all, I'll start off with some observations. One, there are four Japanese manufacturers in MotoGP. Two, there is one Japanese tire manufacturer in MotoGP. Three, actually that's not true, Tom. Dunlop is really pretty much a Japanese company now, so there's two Japanese tire manufacturers in MotoGP. Three, Motegi is the only race in Japan on the schedule since Suzuka was dropped. Four, Motegi is a Honda track. Honda wants to win on it, and every manufacturer wants to beat Honda on its own track. So all of these compound into riders trying harder than usual to impress the company bosses that are in attendance. A win in front of the home bosses will no doubt give leverage in contract talks for the next year. Also, a win here could seal the deal on an unsigned contract for a rider who is grossly overestimating his monetary requirements for next season. I wouldn't be surprised if there was even some monetary bonuses for winning Motegi in a contract or five, read Honda contracts. I believe this to be true because it's well known in the Indy Racing League that Honda values a win on its own Motegi Oval second only to a win at the Indy 500, if not just as much. And then Tom put a postscript on that. More World Superbike. So, well, we'll see about that, Tom. We'll see. I thought that was a pretty good theory. Maybe we'll get some more input, and if I do, I'll be sure to pass it on. Somewhere in there lies the real answer. It's probably different for every rider. Who knows? We'll just keep finding out stuff like that. MotoGPOD listener Francesco Ardia from Italy sent me a couple of articles from the Italian press. Even, like I said, he was also nice enough to translate them for me. The first of these is an interview with Rossi written by Benedetto Ferrara about Rossi's near future. This was featured in a two-page report about MotoGP that showed up in both a large Italian broadsheet newspaper sort of thing called La Repubblica, Il Corriere della Sera, in addition to a daily sports newspaper called La Gazzetta dello Sport. Bits of this have already shown up on Crash.net and other English language sites, but I wanted to read the actual interview for myself. I'm unfortunately not going to read the whole thing here, just a few high points that were kind of interesting. This particular one, actually took place in Japan before the race at Motegi, so it's a little bit out of date. In the interview, Ferrara asked Rossi, if you win on Sunday, what are you going to do? With what attitude will you face the final five races? Rossi answered, not very long ago, I happened to jokingly say to some friends, you know, if I win in Japan, I'm going to go on holiday for the rest of the season. But the truth is that I wouldn't like to be home watching a MotoGP race on TV. Perhaps I am tired of traveling all the time, packing all the time, but then again, come the weekend, I always have fun like a kid. So then Ferrara asked, are you not afraid of some kind of motorcycle nausea? To which Rossi replied, no, meaning that now I don't even know what that means. In the future, I don't know. It's impossible for me to think about what's going to happen in a year or in 2 years. What's certain is that I signed a contract for another year with Yamaha because I want to ride motorbikes and work to win. Ferrara then asked, and after that? And Rossi answers, dunno. The truth is that sometimes I try to think about the future. I wonder, what will I do? But I've never found an answer. What's certain is that it would be difficult for me to think about riding a Yamaha for another 5 years to try and win another five championships. That's kind of significant there, especially for Yamaha. Ferrara then asked, so what happens then? And Rossi says, I don't know, I could change bikes or start afresh, like from the CIV. The CIV is the Campionato Italiano Velocità, which is the Italian Sport Production Bikes Championship, which launched Rossi's career, by the way. And it's a sort of a national production-based series, pretty much the equivalent of AMA Superbike or British Superbike, except that they actually build some of the motorcycles that they race in that country. And Rossi said this with a laugh. Of course, it was sarcasm. After that, there were a few questions about Rossi going to Ferrari and Rossi denying that it's happening anytime soon and that he's not going to test the Ferrari Formula One car every month, as was reported, and so forth and so on. And this is the stuff that I'd heard before, and chances are you have too. But I thought that the bits about his motorcycling future were really interesting, and it might shed a little light on what really is likely to happen. Personally, I think that we're going to see Rossi test with Ferrari again at least a couple times, and I wouldn't be too surprised to see him actually try a Formula One ride in 2007 or 2008. If he does that, make that switch, he really better do well for his own sort of self-esteem, I think. If he goes there and tanks, that's not going to be a good way to sort of end your career. You end up coming back to motorcycles and winning a couple more championships. There was also an interview in Moto Sprint magazine about the Rossi-Melandri crash at Motegi, which basically only tells Valentino's side of it. The reporter for this one, Enrico Borghi, had a major role in writing Valentino's autobiography as well. And I'll tell you, we hear a lot about Motorsprint over here. It's Crash.net is always referring to stuff reported in Motorsprint. Several of the motorcycle magazines here in the States sort of work with Motorsprint, reprinting articles and little short stories. I really wish they had an English language version, or maybe at least a website with the articles that I could then translate in Google. But the only site that I can find for the magazine just has the table of contents for the current issue and a cartoon of the week and that sort of thing. Okay. Talking about what happened right after the race, when Honda made a complaint to Race Direction about the incident, Rossi says, "I couldn't believe it when I found myself wanted in Race Direction due to the official complaint by HRC. It all seemed absurd to me. My move wasn't one that was against the rules. It was just a race accident like so many others. After the fall, I went to see Marco, who was on the ground, and I immediately apologized to him. As a matter of fact, I feel sorry more for what happened between the two of us than for my fall." Borghi then says that someone knew exactly what they were doing to make that report to Race Direction, and Rossi replies to that. "It's the usual story. Those who can't win on the track will look for solutions outside of it," which, ouch. I mean, that's, you know, I guess it's true, but it's still, you can't kind of, well, I guess you can, but just saying that, it's a little weird. However, Rossi continues, "However, if Race Direction had taken this complaint into consideration, I would be worried. Because at that point, if they had disqualified me from the next race, I would have thought that it would be a move to try and raise the interest in the championship, to try and raise the TV share or the ticket sales. That is, all the things that have nothing to do with what sport is actually about." And it's, come on, Rossi, that's what it's all about in the end, unfortunately. So don't tell me you actually believe that stuff, but whatever. The Borghi then says that the thing that's been on everybody's mind, which is certainly mine, at least, which is, Jorge Lorenzo has been disqualified, referring to the 250cc race where Lorenzo took out De Angelis in a somewhat similar crash to Rossi's move on Melandri, and Rossi had this to say about that. "Lorenzo has been taking down other riders all year round. He did it with Pedrosa and De Angelis. The accident with Melandri was a totally different thing. I am an extremely correct rider. Even those who don't like me so much, like Biaggi or Gibernau, will tell you that." Rossi continues, "We are going too far into the turn, both of us." And I think here he means actually outbraking themselves. He might mean delaying the apex too much, but I don't really recall that being all that late of an apex on that corner. It looked like they were going pretty tight. So I think he's talking about outbraking himself, but whatever. He says, "We were going too far into the turn, both of us. But Marco managed to brake better than I did. I crashed into his bike. It was my mistake. But to say that I did it on purpose, that's really far-fetched." And I agree, nobody would think it was on purpose. It was an extremely hard hit. An overly aggressive move that got out of hand, maybe, but definitely not intentional. Back to Rossi, talking about Jerez, where a similar aggressive pass pushed Gibernau off the track. "That was the only episode when someone actually complained, but on that day we both remained on the bike and in the track, and in the end I got first place and Gibernau second. Nothing eventually happened, no one fell off. This time, however, with Melandri, I didn't want to attack to overtake." Borghi says to that, "Say what?" Which, you know, seriously, that's exactly what he said. "Say what?" And Rossi says, "I wasn't preparing to overtake Marco. I didn't have the pace to do that. My strategy for the race at that time consisted of waiting for the right time. I knew Loris had the pace for a great finale, and I was just trying to keep a good pace myself, nothing more." About this whole Rossi crash, you may have seen the TV coverage. There's a part where Rossi is seen walking back to the pits, and he's going into the Kawasaki Yamaha garage, and he's speaking in Italian to his ever-present friend Uccio. And turns out what he actually said, translated, was, "I couldn't avoid taking him down with me," which I thought was kind of cool. I heard that on the coverage, but I had no idea what he was talking about, and Francesco cleared that up for me, so that was very cool. Appreciate that input. And my version of the whole thing is that Rossi was doing his usual Rossi thing of pressuring the next rider up the grid, pressuring him until they make a mistake. And while doing that, he saw what he thought might be an open door for a pass, and he just got a little bit over-aggressive. And like we're going to hear in a minute or two with our eyewitness race report from Motegi, there's a steep downhill entry into that 90R corner, and Rossi might just have misjudged a little bit, proving that perhaps, after all, he's really just human.
Hi, this is Doug Davis from the All Things Ducati podcast. Show number 5 is up, and we're celebrating Caparossi's convincing win in Japan. Also, an Italian motorcycle news roundup and riding under a full moon. Check us out at allthingsducati.lipston.com or through your local podcast directory. Now back to MotoGPOD.
I got a cool eyewitness race report from the Japanese Grand Prix from listener Yoshi Uchiyama in Japan. As far as race results, I cannot keep avoiding spoilers and all that forever, so it's been a week since the race, and I'm going to have to talk about the race. But I know that, here at least in the United States, they haven't even shown the 125cc race on speed, and we're going to be talking about that a little bit. So if you're trying to save that race for when they finally do show it on October 4th, and you don't want to learn anything about it, well, first of all, good luck with that. And second of all, I'll do my part, and here's what I'll do. Skip ahead to 25 minutes, 28 seconds. And then I'll also put that time code in the show notes and on the website, and so that you'll know when this particular race report ends, and you can skip ahead and listen to the rest of the show, the last segment, which is our Sepang preview, but not hear this part if you are trying to avoid the 125s. Good luck with that. Okay, so here's Yoshi's report. He says in his email, "Hi Bob, how are you doing? I went to Motegi yesterday. I enjoyed it very much. Here's my report. Actually, this is the first time to go to Motegi for me. Motegi is northeast of Tokyo, though not so easy to get to. Well, if you drive there, and you left early, not bad. But it is simply that Motegi is far from the motorway or any main road, and all access routes are easily packed up. Anyway, we got there just after the 125 morning practice finished, about 9:30, and we left for home at 6 p.m. As I mentioned before, we had grandstand tickets for the 90-degree corner. In my opinion, this is the best place to watch at Motegi. First of all, lots of passing and action occurs. You can see a bit of the other part of the circuit, and it's better than the main grandstand because that one is too far from the road race course, because the oval course is between them. Other grandstands are near the V-corner, and the oval stand is near the victory chicane." Yossi also included a photo that I'm going to post on the website, so make sure to check out that view that he had there from turn 10. Okay, back to Yossi. A temporary back of a lorry screen had set up near turn 10. By the way, this year, wireless LAN was set up in all the stands, so you could bring your laptop and watch live timing, which, that's really cool. I heard that Laguna Seca, even the press, were having difficulty getting internet access. I can't imagine them giving it to wireless to everybody in the grandstands. That's awesome. Yoshi continues, "You don't notice from TV or photos, but the later half of the back straight is steep downhill. Then the road is still down towards the underpass. Just imagine how difficult it must be on downhill braking to judge your stopping power. It was really hot and strong sunshine yesterday, over 30 degrees C, which is 86 Fahrenheit, by the way, toasty hot. And the road surface temp was nearly 50, which is about 120 degrees Fahrenheit. It's tire melting hot." Okay, Yoshi says, "For the 125 race, it was a really interesting race. Top group was 9 riders. It seems no one really could get their pace up, mainly because of the heat. For the 125s, the back straight is slipstreaming and passing point. Luthi was the best on the back straight maneuver. We believed he would lead the race towards the end, but as you saw, it was red flagged. A similar accident had happened last year." And if you haven't watched that 125 race, you really need to do so. It like I said earlier, it doesn't even get broadcast in the U.S. until October 4th, which I just love the way they wait 3 weeks. But I watch it on MotoGP.com, and it was a fantastic race. And that incident that brought out the red flag was huge. It was one of those big ones that you watch, and you just can't believe that nobody's, very seriously injured or something like that, which, thank God, nobody was. The final results ended up being for that race. Mika Kallio in first, Thomas Luthi second, and Hector Faubel third. Even though Luthi, who came in second, had actually crashed out and even caused the red flag. But when the red flag went, they revert to the last completed lap. Luthi probably won't be able to race at Malaysia due to a dislocated shoulder, but the rider that really was lucky to escape, very lucky, was Sergio Gadea, who literally crashed into Luthi's motorcycle, and it was amazing. You guys have to see it. Okay, back to Yoshi's report. The 250 race. It was Aoyama's race, for my pronunciation there, Yoshi. Everyone at Motegi was cheering to him, and he did respond to that. I saw his brother fall off, unlucky. Yoshi didn't go into a whole lot more detail than that on the 250 race, but it ended up being that it was a race for second place after Hiroshi Aoyama broke away from the pack and pretty much checked out. The last six or eight laps or so were fantastic. I was literally on the edge of my seat there. You're watching Pedrosa just move up from like sixth place and make it look super easy as he picks off the other riders one by one and makes his way up through the field. When Pedrosa comes next year into the MotoGP class, it's going to be fantastic. In any event, final podium ended up there. Hiroshi Aoyama, Danny Pedrosa in second, and Casey Stoner in third. De Angelis and Lorenzo were in second and fourth on that last lap, and then Lorenzo made his move to pass both Pedrosa and De Angelis, and he ended up taking out himself and De Angelis. De Angelis managed to get back into the race, and he ended up finishing seventh, whereas Lorenzo was done, and Lorenzo has been banned from Sepang as a penalty, which may be sort of a cumulative thing, because he has been a little bit wild this whole season. But that's the sort of issue that we were facing earlier, where we're talking about, well, you know, Lorenzo gets banned and Rossi doesn't, and that sort of thing. In any case, back to Yoshi's report. For the MotoGP race, it happened right in front of me, but I was watching the top two, Loris and Max. Suddenly, two blue bikes were tangled and went off to the gravel. There are two lines here. For a good lap time, stay outside and slow down enough, and it makes it easy to accelerate after the 90R turn. Though to pass another rider, you come inside, braking much harder and compromising acceleration. I saw these patterns in all classes, and quite a few riders made a mistake. Remember, it's downhill here. Right after a crash, Rossi was posing anger and blaming Melandri. Then he approached Melandri and was concerned about his injury. Rossi looked really disappointed. I asked Yoshi if he thought whether Rossi was trying to pass Melandri on that corner or not. Because after the race, Rossi had said he was not trying to pass him. And Yoshi replied this, "Yes, though he realized that he couldn't when he started braking. Even though I didn't see exactly how it happened to them, I was watching all day at that corner." The best example is lap 4 of the 250cc race. At about 25 minutes and 30 seconds into the full video race of the race on MotoGP.com, Lorenzo passed Dovizioso. Dovizioso wasn't even aware of Lorenzo until he saw him on his right. If Dovizioso knew Lorenzo was coming, he could slow down a bit more and turn his bike sharper, and then he can pass Lorenzo again. In Rossi and Melandri's case, they took almost the same line as Lorenzo and Dovizioso. Though Rossi wasn't close enough to Melandri, maybe because of the power difference between the Honda and the Yamaha, but Rossi already went to the inside of Melandri. If Melandri wasn't aware that Rossi was behind him, the only result would be a collision. So what Rossi was saying was that Melandri should have been aware that someone was behind him because he made an earlier mistake, Melandri had, and clearly someone was catching up. And that, Yoshi, is a really interesting take on that whole thing. I liked that a lot. And basically, Yoshi and I tend to agree that it was pretty clearly Rossi's mistake that caused the whole crash as the passing rider. And Yoshi says that, you know, he thinks, you know, I think this does not deserve a penalty. As Melandri said, it was one of those things. But if it was one of those things, Tomata should not have been disqualified in 2003, which it did right there, Yoshi. So, continuing, Yoshi says, Nicky Hayden did a mistake at turn 10, the 90-degree corner, on lap 8. I saw it all. He misjudged braking, but he managed to turn a corner, though his machine went outside and he ran into the gravel. He kept his bike upright and kept accelerating, and he managed to get back on track. I didn't see Matsudo race at all, because he crashed out at the hairpin on the first lap. The first corner of the first lap was okay this year, however, many riders fell off or retired. At Motegi, it's about survival. I knew that on the way back out of the circuit, there would be a long queue, so we went to the Honda Collection Hall. It's free once you've entered the circuit. It has a brilliant collection of two- and four-wheeled race cars, road cars, and motorbikes. Mainly Honda, though some other makes too. We ended up getting home at 11 p.m. All right, That was great. Thank you very much for sharing that with us, Yoshi. And anyone else that goes to a Grand Prix anywhere, send me an email with your race report or impressions or hints and tips or whatever. Or make an audio file. That would be even better, you know, if it's you telling your thing. I like the idea of hearing, you know, just regular guys that go to a race and hearing about their experiences at these races. And I'll tell you, if you ever do get to Motegi, you got to go to that Honda Collection Hall. You can see some pictures, a very, very few, on the Motegi's official website, which is something like twinringmotegi.co.jp or something along those lines. Just Google for Twin Ring Motegi, and you'll find the site, and check out the pictures there, because it's a pretty awesome museum. Now it's time for our Malaysia Grand Prix preview. After the drama of the 12th round of the season at Motegi last weekend, the MotoGP World Championship continues its Asian adventure this weekend at Sepang. Valentino Rossi will get his second shot at locking up his fifth consecutive title after the first chance disappeared in a cloud of Japanese dust in his only race crash of the season so far. The Sepang circuit is 5.5 kilometers long, about 3.4 miles, and it's one of the most modern on the Grand Prix calendar, and it's also one of the four that is shared with Formula One. Two long straights on either side of a spectacularly ugly grandstand complex make the architecture of the track extremely memorable. This circuit is not all about straight line speed, however. A series of sweeping corners where the back end of the motorcycle will step out and drift will definitely keep the riders on their toes. Due to the hairpins and the hard braking areas, a fast lap comes down to braking stability and the bike's turn-in characteristics. The track surface offers a high level of grip with only a few bumps, but at the same time there's also a couple of very challenging high-speed sweepers. The first, you're diving down into a hollow before climbing back out the other side for a 90-degree right-hander. This corner alone has a tendency to load up the front of the bike to the extreme on the entry and load the rear on the exit. The other is a blind left-hander that disappears over an undulating crest, which ensures that keeping the back end in line will be challenging for even the best riders. So therefore, the ideal chassis setup is going to be somewhat compromised, and the key areas of concern are braking stability and chassis agility under those heavy loads. To help cater to both, the suspension balance will be targeted towards a neutral fill that's similar to what's used at Motegi. The front fork springs will be set slightly firmer, achieved with a higher spring rate, with the bike's attitude controlled by the spring preload. Softer damping settings will improve feel and leaving the heavier springs to deal with the high cornering and braking forces. As for the rear shock, it will carry a higher spring rate, but the damping will still be smooth to give the riders the feel that they're needed to get the power down hard and predictably in conditions that can melt a rear tire in a matter of laps. Thank you very much to Yamaha, by the way, for that setup info. Very cool stuff. The second half of the season is the part with all the flyaway races. So where the teams are going to leave their cozy little European nests and venture out into the world. So this means that there's going to be a lot of races in a fairly short time. And even though the championship is likely to be locked up this weekend here at Sepang, very likely, there's no reason to stop paying attention. The race for second place in the championship is very, very close, with seven riders separated by about 35 points, meaning that all of them still have a realistic chance of taking second in those five races that are left. Plus, each race is well worth watching on its own merit, not just as part of an overall championship series. And I think that's going to be even more true, that each race is worth watching on its own, after Rossi locks up his championship, because it's going to be interesting to see how Rossi races and strategizes for the rest of this season. Will he race just as hard as ever to try to be the winner, even against his own teammate Colin Edwards, or will he do what he can, say, to help Edwards, you know, snag that runner-up in the championship spot and help improve his team standing, that sort of thing? Edwards is currently in third. It's about 16 points behind Mad Max Biaggi, so it's not inconceivable to imagine Rossi letting Edwards pass him for a victory if they're running first and second or something along those lines. And maybe I should say that it's not inconceivable for a team member to do something like that, because we are seeing that in Formula One right now with Montoya and Raikkonen. But it might be a little harder to imagine Rossi doing it, not because he's a bad guy, but just because he's just so driven and Rossi-like. There's a few records that Rossi can break or tie. for the rest of the season, and I think he's going to try and do a lot of that. His string of consecutive podium appearances was ended at 14 by his crash at Motegi, so he cannot break Wayne Rainey's record there of 15 podiums in a row that Wayne did in 1989 and 90. But there's others, including the most wins in a single season in the 500cc or MotoGP class, which is currently held by Mick Doohan with 12 wins in 1997. Rossi right now has 9 this season, and he could end up with 14. There's also the record of most podiums in a single season in the Premier class, once again, which is a record that's held by none other than Valentino Rossi, with the 16 podiums in 2003. So far this year, Rossi has 11 podium appearances in 12 races, and he could easily tie that record. Then there's the record for most points scored in a single season in the top class. And once again, the number is achieved by Valentino Rossi with 357 points in 2003. Right now, Rossi has 261 points, and if he wins all 5 of those remaining races, he'll have 386 points, which would be, you know, a staggering achievement. After Motegi, the championship runner-up Biaggi is the only rider with an outside chance of stopping Rossi's championship drive. And it's very, very much of an outside chance. Biaggi must score 13 points more than Rossi at Sepang just to stay mathematically alive for that top spot in the championship. And the odds are heavily stacked against him. What with Rossi already being a 2-time winner at Sepang, including last year on the Yamaha. And, of course, just being mathematically in that running doesn't really mean that Max has much of a chance. I mean, it just means that it's remotely possible in Bizarro world. Even if something really super bad were to happen and Rossi was somehow out for the rest of the season, which we certainly don't want, Max would have to pick up 112 points in 5 races out of a possible of 125. That means, you know, like 3 wins in 2 seconds or something like that to get that kind of a number. That's a lot of points in 5 races. And judging from the season that Max has had so far this year, I doubt that he could do it, Rossi or not, in the equation. So, realistically, although, like I said, it's not a mathematical done deal, it's, to all intents and purposes, a done deal. However, Biaggi's chances of taking the runner-up spot for the 4th time in his Premier Class career were boosted by his well-deserved and hard-fought 2nd place at Motegi. And while Biaggi has previously won here at Sepang, taking a victory in 2002 for Yamaha, Colin Edwards, who, like I just said, is in 3rd place in the championship, 16 points behind Max, only managed to pick up 11th place at Sepang last season while riding the Telefonica Movistar Honda, and he hasn't been on the podium since he took 2nd place at Laguna Seca this year. So Colin's been kind of struggling in the last few races. Hopefully he's going to get that sorted out and kind of show up front. Marco Melandri, who went down in that collision with Rossi at Motegi, saw his own very slim mathematical chances of winning that title slip away completely in that incident. He's currently standing in 4th place in the championship. He's got 126 points, and that DNF at Motegi kind of shook things up for him a little bit, moving him down a notch. It's not certain that Melandri will even compete at Sepang. He flew into Kuala Lumpur with the rest of the Gresini Racing team on Monday, but he just had to have surgery on his right foot for this deep flesh wound that was caused by like a foot peg piercing his boot, which makes my feet hurt just thinking about it. And the latest news I have is that he's missed Friday practice, but he may go out on Saturday. So we'll see. Good luck to you, Marco. You know, hope you have a speedy recovery. We hope to see you out there. Nicky Hayden, currently 5th in the championship, and he's going to want to do well at Sepang after a fairly disappointing race at Motegi. He did move up 2 positions in the championship standings after he earned 9, you know, valuable points, but on his website he described his problems at Motegi. "I never felt good on the bike, and all the things we found at the Brno test just didn't work here. I was able to put a little something out of the bag to qualify on the 2nd row, but I just couldn't hold it together for 24 laps. I was going back and forth a bit with Barros when I ran off the track at the end of the back straight. I just got sucked in trying to make a pass and couldn't get stopped and went through the dirt. I stayed on and came back on the track, but when I was off in the dirt, I cut my tire, and I just tried to bring it home from there." So Nicky ended up finishing 4th in his 2 previous races in Sepang, so maybe he can move things up a tiny notch and make the podium here this year. Loris Caparossi arrives in Malaysia in top form after taking Ducati's first victory since their debut success at Catalunya over 2 years ago. The Italian has already signed a deal for 2006 with Ducati, and he's targeting his third successive podium finish at Sepang as he hopes to break into the top five in the championship standings. He's currently in sixth spot, 117 points, just 4 points behind Hayden. Those long straights at Sepang might suit the Ducati well for that prevailing wisdom of horsepower, but old Caparex only managed to get sixth place in both 2003 and 2004, so not 100% sure what we're going to expect from Caparossi. Seti Gibernau's season just seems to have taken a serious turn for the worse. 3 DNFs out of the last 4 races and 2 fifth-place finishes before that, not to mention his last-lap problem that he had in Germany that saw him muff the lead and just hand the win to Rossi. He's currently 7th in the championship, dropping 2 spots after his journey into the kitty litter at Motegi, so swapping 5th with Hayden, so now he's down to 7th. It's all been described as bad luck for Seti, and sure, a lot of it is luck, but a lot of times you make your own luck. Gibernau is definitely psyched out by Rossi in general, and he's only podiumed 1 time in his whole career at Sepang for 2nd place in 2003. I'm really not too sure what to expect of him this weekend, but I do not see a podium finish for Gibernau. I'm not sure if I even mentioned this, what with the disruption from my trip to Amsterdam and all that business, but Seti signed with Ducati for next year, amazingly enough, to ride alongside Caparossi. Apparently, Telefonica Movistar is withdrawing their sponsorship from Gresini Racing, and that removes the main reason that he's there. That whole thing is kind of in a tiff about Pedrosa moving up to the HRC Honda team instead of the Telefonica Movistar Honda team in MotoGP. Telefonica's like, well, fine, you know, if we can't have Danny Pedrosa, then we're going to take our toys and play in Formula One with Alonso. So, whatever. For Gibernau, you know, no Spanish primary sponsor. Apparently, no need for a Spanish rider, especially one that seems to have developed a slight attitude problem lately anyway. I'm not really 100% sure that's fair to say about Seti. I've always really liked him, but something is definitely up. And I'd say it's going from the frying pan into the fire to switch to the Ducati, but apparently he's happy with the idea. On the other hand, this year's second Ducati rider, Carlos Checa, his future is a little bit uncertain. It doesn't look good for him, but depending on what happens with the Yamaha teams next year, he might possibly get a seat there again. And by the way, that's a rumor that I just started, so feel free to spread it around. Let's see if it shows up in print. Alex Barros, who showed us the somewhat disturbing display of his calligraphic penmanship, or I guess I should say brushmanship, right before the Japanese Grand Prix, is 8th in the championship with 114 points. Not sure what to say about Barros. Except for his win at Estoril in the 2nd race of this season, he's just been kind of consistently poking along with slightly less inspiring performances. You know, solid, certainly, but not spectacular. And plus, he's crashed out of 25% of the races this year. He kind of goes in a pattern of 3 finishes, a crash, 3 finishes, a crash. And so he's got 3 more finishes to go because he just crashed at Motegi. On the other hand, he finished 3rd at Sepang last year, so maybe he's strong at the circuit and in 2002. So I say we should look for him to be in the top 4 finishers certainly here. Okay, that's the top 8 in the standings that we covered. Let's talk about the rest of the field. First of all, Troy Bayliss, who will miss his 2nd consecutive race due to a wrist injury that he sustained in a motocross training accident while in Australia. He's going to be replaced on that yellow Camel Honda by Shane Byrne. Shaky, who is a former British Superbike champion, hasn't ridden since his home round at Donington Park in July after the split between Team KR and their engine supplier KTM. But he's going to have a major chance to impress over the next couple weekends because he's already tentatively scheduled to replace Bayliss in Qatar as well. So we should see Shane Byrne at both Sepang and Qatar, which is kind of cool. You know, Shane has tested quite a bit at Sepang, so he sort of knows that circuit. We'll just see how well he does. And I've heard that if Bayliss doesn't come back for the following 3 races at Phillip Island, Valencia, and... the other one, then Turkey, we'll see Christopher Mullen from World Superbike moving up, and he probably would have come up instead of Shane Byrne, except for his contractual obligations and all that, and couldn't leave, so that's kind of cool. Not really cool for Shane, but kind of cool for Mullen. Okay, back to the MotoGP guys. Alex Hoffman is also going to miss out Sepang because of a broken bone in his foot when he collided with Robbie Rolfoot at Motegi. Rolfo escaped unhurt, but Hoffman is definitely out of the next 2 rounds, and he's headed back to receive treatment in Europe. Hoffman's place at Kawasaki will be taken by Olivier Jacques, who also stepped in for Hoffman earlier in the season, and that at that time grabbed the team's only podium of the year in a stunner of a race performance in the pouring down rain at Shanghai. I wonder if Rossi's pit crew is going to have a card with OJ's initials, you know, that's actually manufactured, ready to put on the pit board for his race. You know, in Shanghai, they had to make something with like a felt-tip pen and a cereal box or tape or something, I don't know. And when they were trying to communicate with Rossi, you know, who was coming up behind him and how far back he was, and Rossi probably damn near fell off the motorcycle when he trying to remember who the hell OJ was. Certainly not expecting a Kawasaki right behind him, especially one driven by what everybody has sort of considered with his has-been. But never underestimate the guy without a ride. Olivier is a good rider, and I think he'll probably put in a decent performance this weekend to prove himself after his very disappointing first-lap DNF in Germany when he was a wild card for Kawasaki. So, you know, he'll do okay. I'll bet that he's doing a rain dance right now, for sure, to want to see the podium in Sepang. His Kawasaki teammate Shinya Nakano was pretty upset after two engine failures during the Motegi weekend, including one that ended his race. He finished 8th on the Kawasaki at Sepang last year, and not a horrible result considering, so he might do okay. We'll have to see, Shinya. John Hopkins achieved a milestone with his 5th place finish at Motegi after an excellent qualifying session, and I think that all that made him pretty happy. He signed with Suzuki for the next 2 seasons, and if all goes well in the Suzuki camp, maybe we'll see him on the podium before too much longer. He certainly has the talent. He just needs a more competitive machine to display it. It doesn't look so rosy for Kenny Roberts Jr., however. I'm not sure if Suzuki has flat out decided, you know, not to re-sign him for the next year, or if they're just kind of playing their cards close to their chest and doing the wait-and-see thing or what. But if Suzuki doesn't pick up Kenny Roberts again, I'm pretty much not sure who will. Rumor was that James Toseland was coming to Suzuki's MotoGP team from his current Ducati ride over in World Superbike, but I haven't heard a lot about that lately, so I'm not sure. And Makoto Tomata finished 5th at Sepang last year, but he was on the Bridgestone tires then, and this year he's on Michelins, and he has not been able to deliver this year on those Michelins very well. But it also might be factors about the different team that he's on. Same motorcycle, different team. In any event, he's going to want to do well here, but we'll have to see what happens with old Makoto. And then look for Tony Elias and Ruben Schaus to be in the back as usual. I really don't know what's up with either of those guys. They both have gobs of talent, and they're on the same basic motorcycle as Rossi and Edwards, but they're just not doing it. Elias really hasn't had much of a year. He is a rookie to the top class, so you know maybe that's it, and you've got to give these guys a chance, and you can't slam on them. Just, you know, there's a first year, and he is in the lead for Rookie of the Year. But on the other hand, he came up from 250cc, so he knows all these tracks. He just can't seem to translate it to the big bike. But, you know, it takes time. So hopefully he'll get that time and a little bit more time to develop. Charles, though, on the other hand, just had a disastrous year. He was doing better on the Ducati last year. And I'd have to say that the Yamaha is pretty much clearly a better motorcycle, I would think. Rumor has it that Charles is going back to World Superbike next year. Or maybe it was AMA Superbike. I don't know. But can't remember where I saw it, but suffice to say, it ain't a MotoGP ride. Robbie Rolfo, another rookie that came up from a fairly promising 250 career, but really isn't performing all that well in the top class. He did have issues even in the 250s, with all kinds of bad press a couple years back about how Honda screwed him by making the 250 that was too small for him, even though he helped develop the previous bike into a winner and blah, blah, blah. And the Danton Primac team is hurting for certain in the money department, so that's never good, so not too sure how Robbie's career is doing, and I'm not too sure how well he's going to do at Sepang, other than he'll certainly be in the bottom half of the grid. Franco Battaini and James Ellison will come out on their hugely non-competitive WCMs and turn in their heart-wrenching performances that we always see as a rolling chicane, as usual. Ellison really deserves a better ride, and I hope that he gets it. What I hope that even more than that is that WCM somehow pulls off a miracle and gets that Blada V6 that we've heard about and heard about and heard about, and then it turns the WCM into this great motorcycle. But I can tell you for sure that's not happening anytime soon. Battaini, not too sure about. I just don't have a lot of information about the guy, and you never see any coverage of these two guys in the back. Battaini may be a comparative flash in the MotoGP pan, kind of like his predecessor Michele Fabricio was, but without the contractual difficulties parts. All right, so that covers our rider report there for the championship standings and the Malaysia preview. Hope you kind of enjoyed that. All right, that's going to do it for today's episode. It was a long one, quite a monster. Thank you very much for downloading it. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I enjoyed making it. As always, feel free to send me an email, motogpod@motogpod.com. Questions, comments, donations, criticism, hate mail, whatever. I read it all, and I'm always looking for race reports, like I said, like Yoshi's. So if you happen to be going to Sepang for the Malaysian Grand Prix, write something up and send it in. Or record something in your own voice, whatever you want. If you have photos to share, you know, either I can host them on my website or I'll link to your site. Whatever works best, just let me know. And Monday we'll have a wrap-up for the Sepang race. I'm looking forward to watching the race, and I will talk to you then. Goodbye. MotoGP is a trademark of Dorna Sports SL. The MotoGPOD podcast and MotoGPOD.com are not affiliated with Dorna Sports SL. All other trademarks are the property of their respective owners. MotoGPOD isn't affiliated with any of them.